I'm Mike Asnald, and welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series podcast. This is a series where we talk to artists who are doing amazing things in the areas of the arts, including performance, education, production, as well as arts advocacy. We record this series in the Virginia and John Nolan Black Box Studio, as well as in the Jan and Bill Grimes Recording Studio here at the Cary Siraj Community Arts Center. Be sure to visit artsbr.org for more information on all the great things we are doing here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Hope you enjoy the podcast series, and thanks for tuning in.
Thank you. All right, I'd like to welcome our AC 23 Plus viewers and listeners to another session. And today I have an old friend, amazing saxophonist from Fort Worth, Texas, who spent quite a bit of time in Baton Rouge, starting with Alvin Batiste. We're going to get into that a little bit. But Quamon Fowler, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
It's good to see you.
Yes, sir.
We played some music a minute ago, and it was, it's always great to hook up musically and just to talk,
mm-hmm.
catch up.
Definitely.
Well, I'm going to tell the listeners a little bit, just bio stuff and let them know what's going on. But first of all, you're here because you live in Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But you're here for the next couple of days because you're doing a concert at over at the Manship Theater in the Hartley Vay studio with your band, right?
Right. Well, the band I put together.
The band you put together.
Yes.
But you were just telling me a mutual friend, a wonderful pianist from Texas.
Yeah.
Fred Sanders is going to be joining
Fred Sanders. Yeah. So this, the idea was I wanted to bring together Mr. Batiste's former students. Mm-hmm. And so you have, generations represented because Fred was one of the ones that came before us. Me and John,
right.
So me and John Jones were there together, and then Max Moran and Chris Royal were the last ones
over at NOCA.
At NOCA, yeah,
yeah.
Of Mr. Bass students.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's gonna be a great band.
Mm-hmm.
So has that configuration played together before over this period?
No, not at all. So it's gonna be interesting and fun. So
yeah,
looking forward to it.
Well, some accolades before we jump into, just some general questions.
Okay.
But so did you get your undergrad at Southern?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was studying with Alvin Batiste.
Yeah. I went and I did the two-year program, of course, with Mr. Bat. Then I finished with a performance degree, the four-year there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you went on, you got a master's degree in Texas, right?
Yeah, Texas Tech after that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is impressive, man. Third place winner in the 2008 International Thelonious Monk Jazz Saxophone Competition. And I'm fully aware of that competition, and that's a very prestigious,
mm-hmm.
competitive thing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it was something really that I always wanted to do since high school because I saw that Joshua Redman had won it back in 95 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I was like, I want to do that competition and not just do it. I'm going to win it,
Yeah.
So that was my attitude there back in 2015.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Or 2008?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I said 2015. That's 95. So it's actually 2008, yeah.
Yeah.
I got the five in there, but I put a one in front of it for some reason. But anyway, yeah, 95, and so 2008, I was able to win third place in the competition.
Yeah.
So it was, and back then I was always doing competitions and programs and different things that I'd found out about because I just wanted to participate in as much as I can and opportunities that came by.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, a time where you was just really sharpening your axe and wanted to gauge where you stood,
right?
In the midst of people your age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
9 albums?
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is most of those, or are most of those original material?
Yes, most original material. My first one is called Introducing Quamon Fowler, and after my first year at Southern, Mr. Bat said, he's like, hey, it's time for you to record an album. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went home. You get out in May. I went home over the summer, and by the time I came back in August, I had the CD.
Yeah. So putting that together or just putting albums together in general, What does that look like as far as the writing part of it? Are you generally kind of like by yourself just working out tunes, or like how do tunes come to you? How do you compose?
It's so crazy now. It's much different than it was back then, because at the time, 2000s, I would have my computer and I had a score writing program. Excuse me. At the time, it was called GenieSoft Score Writer.
Okay.
And so I would just click all the notes in, you know. And I might have recorded things on a tape recorder. I always would carry a tape recorder. And so I would sing the ideas in there. But most of the time, I would just click in all of the notes and write like that. And I wrote a bunch of tunes back then. It's a trip how, you know, now I'm not nearly writing as much, but a lot of the older stuff, I can just look and see what I have and just pull from what I have.
Right, right.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's how it was. I'll be inspired, or I would sit down at the piano and work something out. And then I would capture the sheet music, you know, with the computer.
Right. One thing I'm always interested in when I'm talking to artists, especially musicians, is the formative years, like when you're just getting into it, and you know, what was it that drew you to music? With, you know, some people come from musical families, some people don't. But can you kind of talk to that? Like, how did you get into music?
It was definitely coming up in church and experiencing hearing the choir, hearing the musicians, the organ, you know, drums. Back then, I came up in Baptist church, but we would have musicals all the time. And so just being in that environment and the church musicians coming and playing. And I remember it was a guy, Gerald Carter. He came and he was playing trumpet along with the gospel choir, and I'm hearing him and I'm hearing something else. I'm hearing like a little bit more depth. And so he had a, you know, jazz background. So he was an influence. He probably don't even know that. But him and Jerome Harmon, he's a organist who actually plays saxophone too, but he produced a lot of things in the beginning with Kirk Franklin. So mm-hmm. I'm from that area where gospel is really strong, you know, in the DFW area.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I've always thought, you know, being a teacher for many years, and one of the schools I taught at was primarily African American, and I would get students very often that came out of church.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, I would teach at another school where I didn't have that dynamic. I had sort of, if you want to call it more traditional, you know, early lessons with students or whatever. But I always thought that the students that came out of that environment, the church environment, especially when it's, you know, the ones that had to follow a preacher and basically improvise a lot of times, was such a gift, you know, and those musicians right off the bat had so many things, a lot of the intangibles, you know, the feel of the music, the developed ear, maybe the part that lacked sometimes was, you know, again, the more traditional reading music sometimes,
exactly,
which I've always felt that's something, that's the grammar, you can get that later.
Yeah, right, right.
But those, that, and just being in front of a congregation playing every Sunday, like really having a regular job. At such a young point, that seems like such a blessing for anybody who's interested in, you know, whether it's jazz, R&B, gospel. You know, like, would you agree to that?
Yeah, definitely. It's the roots. It's the roots of the music, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, even that experience for us coming up, a lot of, you know, African-American, the experience, if you... I guess really 80s, even 90s, like just your upbringing. If you came up in church, you were at church like, you know, Sunday and then Sunday evening sometimes, and then Wednesday, and then Thursday for rehearsals. So,
right.
And then you got a chance to play drums, keys, you know.
Right.
And then you're staying, listening to the choir, do parts and all of that.
For learning harmony.
Yeah, so it's like being exposed to all of that, no matter what instrument you play, you end up soaking in, like, all of that. And then the experience, just the praise and worship experience spiritually and all of the stuff that just rubs off on you in terms of the intent, you know, mm-hmm. behind what you play. So it's like, it's just such a potent environment. And so when you go to other environments, schools and everything, you have an accent or you have a vantage point where, like, when you approach other music, you have a lot more oomph
right.
or soul just because
right.
of your experience being, you know, in church environments.
Sort of a built-in confidence that comes
yes,
from that.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
So why saxophone?
Oh, I always tell the story. I saw it on Sesame Street. And so, yeah, that was a big deal back in the 80s.
Yeah.
But, yes, I saw a video, a presentation. What did they do? They had the making of the saxophone. Oh. And it was just really intriguing. And so just the sound of it. And then also later, Vannard Johnson, who's a famous gospel saxophonist, was a big deal. So whenever they would have revivals, he would come in town and he would get an orchestra. Hmm. And so he would get young guys, people together. So at the time I was playing violin. So my mom had me play violin in his orchestra. And then when I start playing sax, I believe I start playing sax in the orchestra, but it was just something intriguing about it. I don't really know, but but I just liked it.
Right.
So by the time I got to seventh grade, I started playing the saxophone.
So you were involved at some point, like in a like school, like band
mm-hmm.
kind of situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I started. Yeah. In seventh grade, and so middle school. So when I just did some teaching
mm-hmm.
at one of the schools here, and so I was telling the students about how when I went to the band camp that they have to learn the instrument,
yeah.
they only showed us one note on the first day, and I was like, "What's the rest of the notes?" And he was like, "Well, you're going to get that, Mr. Timmons. You're going to get that the rest of the week. We're going to go into the rest of the notes." So I was like, "No, that's not good enough." Like, so I went home, and I figured out how to play the rest of the notes on the saxophone.
Right.
And so I just had a drive to really explore the instrument and discover what it could do, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like a lot of the musicians I've talked to in those formative years, a lot of times they can trace it back. It's not that uncommon to have like a band director or some musical figure that really was a mentor in those years.
Mm-hmm.
Does that apply to you?
Yep. I had, at 12, so by the time I guess it's funny because ever since I started playing saxophone, I guess earlier on, you could say Mr. Vannard Johnson, because I was in the orchestra and I listened to a lot of his stuff. But then when I was 14, I participated in a competition, AXO competition, NAACP AXO competition. So it's an African American
mm-hmm.
Competition where they have different arts, visual and performing arts, liberal arts. And so for me, finding out about that and being encouraged to do it, I was able to meet Rachella Parks. She was probably around at UNT when you were.
May have been.
Yeah.
May have been.
She played saxophone.
Okay.
She was there with Shelley Carroll and Brad Lely, I believe.
Oh, that may have been a little bit before I got
before.
There.
Before, okay.
Yeah, because I missed Shelley.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
I think he had just left.
So, but Rochella, she was an educator, and so she heard me, and so she was so intrigued, so she started working with me. And that was the bridge. So she got me into Dexter Gordon and James Clay and Gene Ammons. So she was the bridge. That's when she opened my world up.
a lot of Texas tenors. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So, and she really helped the formative years. So it's like the perspective was, for her, like, you play from your heart and soul, and you tell your story. You know, she was always encouraging me. It's like you're a preacher, you know, through the horn. And so she was real big on you being natural, to being yourself, and, like, just playing from a place of conviction and intention and heart. And so once I started learning about, like I said, the Ornette Cobbs and even King Curtis, and these guys, they were Texas tenors. They were from my area. Went to I.M. Terrell, you know, that's where my dad went to school. Ornette Coleman as well.
Yeah.
Dewey Redman, Joshua Redman's dad.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, man, this is some serious history, you know, around the saxophone.
Right.
And so I felt that I needed to learn that, be a part of that lineage and kind of learn what came before, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, so when I first met you, you had moved to Baton Rouge, and you were going to Southern to study with Alvin Batiste.
Yeah.
So prior to that, though, like just being in Texas, you know, in those later high school years, were you starting to, like, you know, like play gigs or like play with musicians, kind of playing tunes and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so it's something, because when I started at age 12, when I was 14, I started playing like professional gigs and stuff.
Oh, so
like
you were on this in the trenches, so to speak, real early.
I was doing stuff, and I was so forward thinking with recording, and so when I won this that competition in high school, I was able to get a four-track recorder, the Tascam four-track recorder.
Yeah.
And so I would take myself and stack myself playing, and then I would also get the Jamie Abesall play-alongs, and I would record myself playing tunes like that. And so I would use those play-alongs to play gigs.
Oh, okay.
And so... then my mom, because she was a school teacher, she had all of the supplies. You know, she would always be going to Office Depot. So we would get the card stock, business cards. We'd get the cutouts, inserts for tapes and stuff. So I would make tapes of myself playing tunes.
Yeah.
And I would sell them.
So you were out there doing it, like with the Tascam.
Yeah, I was recording, and I was exploring, you know. I was stacking myself, saxophone, harmony, and stuff like that, learning tunes, and playing the Jamie Abesall recording. So, and the thing, like I even talk about it now with my students, it's very important to record yourself and evaluate, you know, much like how the sports players do, you know, studying their opponent or studying games, you know, like they say, they refer to it as film.
Right.
So the team players will look at previous games just to analyze what happens on the court or what happened on the field or wherever. So it's the same thing that we need to do. We have to record ourselves playing gigs, listening back to it. And I still do to this day. I'm like always recording, you know.
Yeah, I always found it interesting for myself, you know, the way I hear, and I think this applies to a lot of people, the way you hear yourself when you're playing, when you're in the action of playing, very often is different than when you step aside and you just listen to that recording of you playing.
Right, exactly.
Because I guess because you have so many other things, neurosensory going on when you're playing, it could be just the excitement of the moment that affects how you hear. But because there were many times where I'm like, oh man, I was killing. And then I go back and I'm like, oh man, wait a minute. Yeah. Or vice versa. Like, you know. Yeah.
And you know, the thing that's, yeah, because like the spirit of the moment, you're taking in the energy and you're getting a feel for other guys you're playing with, you know, and then you're trying to, you have what you want to do. Like if you prepare something or if you're not prepared, you know what I'm saying? All of these things are going on in your mind, then the energy of the crowd. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of trying to find the right spaces, you know, in the moment. But then once you're listening outside in listening, mm-hmm. it's like you're chilling. It's like you're being entertained.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's different.
And you can really listen with a fine tooth comb, you know, with all the details.
And then surprise yourself. So, I mean, it could go to both ways. Sometimes you'll be playing something and you think it's really good. Then you go back and listen to it. It's like, oh, that wasn't good.
Right.
And then sometimes when you can be in your head and thinking that you're not getting it, and then you go back and listen to it, like, man, that was pretty good.
Right.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so tell me about, you know, the years you spent with Alvin Batiste and what that did for you and just that experience.
So when I won that competition in 98, one of the judges was like, you need to go study with Mr. Bat. And so my brother went to Southern. He's 10 years older. He went to Southern. And then I heard that Branford had went to Southern. He's 20 years ahead.
Right.
And so Wessel Anderson went to Southern and Don Harrison. So when I was researching, I learned about these guys who studied with him. And then Fred Jackson also, mm-hmm. he came down. He's from Fort Worth. So I just saw a trail. Did Keith Loftus?
Yeah, Keith did come through.
He come through?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Keith Loftus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I heard about these guys going through Louisiana to study Mr. Bat. So I was like, okay, well, I'll do the same. And so when I came, I just remember sitting down with Mr. Bat. He went to the piano, and he started playing notes on the piano. Da, what note is that? That's a B flat. Da, like, what note is that? That's a D, you know. You know, I just started naming.
Do you have perfect pitch?
I do, but I know people who are better. I would say I'm close.
Yeah, right.
You know, but I know people who are like a lot quicker.
Right.
Like I can hear it, but I know people who are like John Jones, for instance.
Yeah,
he's like accurate.
Yeah,
you know, but he was doing that with me, and I could tell him the notes and everything, and Mr. Bat was like, I got me one. So he just piled it on me. You know, it's like that Monday. He just made sure we shared it, and he would give me stuff to practice, and he would write stuff, be inspired to write mm-hmm. things. So that was like the beginning of the journey.
I remember during the time I spent with him, it strikes me to this day of, you know, at that time I was 18, 19, and walking into the building and he'd be practicing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All the time. And, you know, the joke was like, if you had those double doors going into the band room and if you were walking past it and he saw you.
Yep, he called you.
Hey, Michael, what you doing? And if you didn't have an answer, well, you're going to be sitting next to him and practicing for about 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But it always struck me, like, here's a guy at that time, probably, I don't know, in his early 60s, I'm guessing, who had the resume. You know, he'd worked with so many people and had the reputation. And this is a guy like who just practiced constantly.
Mm.
Yeah, that was inspiring to me, you know, to see that. As a 19-year-old, like, I don't want to practice. And like, well, Bat's practicing.
Right, right. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it still speaks, you know, to this day. And that's I go back and I think about, well, I was just talking with John Gray, actually, was there with me.
Yeah.
And it was just so funny just seeing John. It's like a lot of that stuff was going over his head. And he just sit down there kind of like with his head down. And he tried to play a little bit, then he put his arm down.
Right.
But it was so funny. But but it was just, it was a trip. We'd be there practicing and going over stuff. I was all eager to learn it. And I would go and practice, go to the practice room. And so, but he had so much information and he was so excited to explore, you know, and I think that was the thing. He just needed, he was motivated by himself. It's like he didn't need any.
I agree.
You know what I'm saying? But it was great when he, I guess when he would see that he had students that were hungry and interested. And that got him more excited to pile it on. So,
and one thing I always dug about Mr. Bout was the way he taught, because it was, his radar was always very up. Like he always knew what you lacked, what you needed, so on and so forth. But the way he gave it to you was always in a sense of humor way, you know. And he'd make you think a little bit about
it. Oh, yeah. So I was going to tell you, you made me think about it because you said you got the Texas tenor sound, the Texas sound.
Yeah.
And so basically when I got there and I was playing, you know, I was, you know, we got pride from Texas. You know, it's just how it is. And so getting here, I'm trying to represent or, you know, let people know, you know, this is Texas. This is what I do, you know. Right. But he told me, he said, hey, man, every time you play, you ain't got to bring the house down. And so he just started telling me, he's like, you country. He told me I was country. And so I just started learning about listening and communication. Like here, that's the big deal, you know. And that's what I learned from playing with Mr. Bad and even Roland. And the different guys. It's like communication is the thing.
Right.
And interacting with each other. It's not about you just individually being killing, you know, hey, look at me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, can you play in a way that allows everybody to participate and enjoy what you're doing?
A real conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't, it's just, I think it's just a regional thing, you know. Being with the brass bands, the tradition of the brass bands, interacting with the cornet and clarinet and, you know, the back and forth communal thing. I think that has gone, or it's weaved itself into even the modern music.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Well, speaking of music, you know, we like I was mentioning earlier, I had the pleasure of being able to record a couple tunes with you before we did this podcast.
That's
so
right.
I'm gonna let us cut to one of our tunes and let the listeners check it out.
Cool. Thank you.
Right, and now we're back. So you're out of college now, and what happens next?
Oh, out of college, so I'm done.
Well, so you finished up at Southern.
Okay. So I was really wanting to stay in Baton Rouge. I mean, everything was going well. I was recording. As a matter of fact, I was working on arranging horn parts for Bethany World Prayer Center's CD. Yeah. And so I did that. I was playing around town, New Orleans. And so I was like, man, you know, I want to stay. But I had my wife, well, at the time, my girlfriend.
Right.
Our fiance. I was trying to get her to apply to LSU, but they didn't accept her. But they did accept her in Texas Tech. And so I was like, man, I didn't want to go to Tech.
right.
But, you know, God saw fit, and something opened at the last minute where somebody didn't take a TA position. So it was a slot that opened where I could be the TA at Texas Tech. And so we went, and I spent the next 5 years of our lives there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so that was a great experience. I mean, Tech is a great school. Mm-hmm. You know, I was there with Alan Sheehan at the time. He's passed now. I played and continued to thrive. I just carried the same energy there, you know, writing music, doing the different competitions. By then, I think it was the NASA competition, the North American Saxophone Alliance. They had a jazz competition, and I participated in that and won first in that. And then I started playing because I did the Jazz and the New Generation program. At the time, Billy Taylor had put it on.
Yeah,
and Dr. Nathan Davis, all these guys are passed on, but they were like the pioneers with jazz education. Even David Baker, I did the Steins Institute, Ravinia, and so these guys helped to give us a platform and presenting the new generation of musicians. So I got a chance to meet a lot of, you know, good guys and, you know, my age that are really well known now, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so being at Tech, was that kind of your first entree into teaching, or were you doing a lot of teaching prior to that? Or
it's interesting. So I've always taught, like, all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just I started, I guess you could say, teaching college students, I guess, formally, you know. So I did teach a jazz band, the second jazz band, and I taught private lessons and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that something that you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, because that's part of my gift is teaching.
Right.
Word of knowledge. It's like that's a part of it. Because I learned that. And this goes into like my book. I later wrote a book, The Christian Musician, Learn What Your Real Gift Is and How to Succeed With and Beyond Your Music. But the key in that book, your gift is not your musical ability. It's the way you think. Music is just one avenue that your giftedness is displayed through.
Mm-hmm.
And so initially, we will, you know, you'll pick an instrument or you'll have a craft or a passion for something. And when you're young, you will use that as a medium of expression. But then later, you know, God will give you that epiphany moment and say, okay, now let me show you what you were doing.
Right.
And so that actually happened to me. Like when I was here in Baton Rouge practicing, always going. It was just a routine thing. I was just used to practicing. And it's like I felt like he was trying to strip things away to get my attention to say, okay, you did that enough. It's time for you to focus on some other things. Yeah. And that was when I started transitioning into being more aware a calling that was bigger than just playing the saxophone or mm-hmm. executing stuff on the saxophone. So I remember practicing at my apartment because we stayed by LSU, but I would ride the bus always to go to Southern.
Yeah.
So me and John were roommates, but I was there by myself and I was practicing, really going at it, and then something like stopped me. It's like, do you see this saxophone? Like, it can't do anything in and of itself unless you put, you know, take it out the case, put the neck on the body, put the mouthpiece on the neck, put the reed on there, lock it in with the ligature. And when you blow, like, it's the saxophone that's being used, but when you play, people are hearing your voice, you know? It's like, yeah. He's like, the same way, you can't do anything separate from me. Like, when you're, I want to use you as my instrument. And then when I really got that revelation, I was like, oh my goodness. You know, I was like, it just blew me away.
Right.
You know, and so, and you, the older you get, the more you start understanding and seeing how God orchestrates stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives you as much as you can handle and understand at that age. But the more you get older, it'll start all kind of filling in, and you see how he can use your gifting that we just channeled or used through music, but then right. it has wired our mind and the way we practice and go about things a certain way to where that's a gifting that we can use to help others, mm-hmm. across the board.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, look, I really appreciate you doing this podcast with me.
Yeah, no problem.
It's great to see you. Great to hear you play again together. So tomorrow night's the concert. So I hope that goes well. I know it will. But and anything on the horizon? Anything you're looking forward to? Before I forget, if people want to follow you, where can they follow you?
They can find me on YouTube. It's Quamon Fowler, my mm-hmm. name, at Quamon Fowler. And the same thing on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And my website is QuamonFowler.com.
Okay.
And I have a sound musician mentorship program. And that's shed.QuamonFowler.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge would like to acknowledge our generous sponsors, the Shell Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, and the City of Baton Rouge.